Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi, Herman and Corin. So as you're probably aware from the news or just from looking outside of our window, central Jerusalem is being dug up at the moment, in particular King George Street, which, as the name suggests, has its origins back in the British Mandate period here, is currently closed off to traffic, and there is just a big building site in the middle and perimeter fencing around it, keeping people out, and it's kind of a mess, to put it mildly. I was picking up something in town the other day, and the guy at the computer store was complaining to me about the noise, which I could totally understand. It's they start legally, you can start construction here at 7 in the morning, and the dust, kicking up lots and lots of dust, and I don't need to remind you guys that I have asthma. So it kind of puts people, he was also saying, it doesn't seem as if the construction is progressing that quickly. Sometimes, you know, at nighttime you see construction crews with like the kind of nighttime lighting, and it feels like, I guess, the municipality is making an effort to minimize disruption or get it done as quickly as they can. But it doesn't seem to be happening that way. I know that after October 7th, a lot had changed with Israel's use of its construction market, and my wife suspects that this may have a lot to do with the issue. Either way, the guy in the tech store was kind of not so impressed by the construction literally happening outside his store. Of course, it affects business as well, keeping customers away. And he said he reckons it's going to be 7 years of digging. That's way longer than what they say, but I'm not sure his skepticism is misplaced. What I'd like to ask you, Herman and Corin, is we have a major project like this going on, and I mentioned I'm very much in favor of public transport, and I think it makes sense. I think most people in the city, not everyone, but most people would agree that developing the light rail network is going to be a good thing for Jerusalem. But we have this perennial issue in Jerusalem because there was a previous light rail project, there's digging happening everywhere, and I think it's a really important question. How do you make a city better? How do you, put down infrastructure for the future without making the city now really unpleasant to live in? And I think that is, we talked about a lot of the issues in Jerusalem, the social issues, namely the high-rise towers, which I don't have. I mean, I think they're fine, and I like them actually, but the luxury housing, we talked about that being a major issue in a poor city like Jerusalem. But they also have, I think there's so many layers of their construction that's problematic. And another layer is that this price for construction is, the bulk of it is borne by these small businesses working in the city centre trying to make a living here. And they're finding that the environmental conditions are worsening. And it seems like the city is taking its sweet time about actually getting this infrastructure built. So Herman and Corin, I ask you these questions not to rant about Israel, but always to ask, how could it be done better? I'm sure Jerusalem is far from the only city around the world working on a major infrastructural upgrade like putting down the light rail network. And even though I don't have any immediate answers off the top of my head, I always feel like there has to be some way to strike a balance between the city as it is now and the city as it's going to be in 8 years after, all this wonderful infrastructure is in place. Because otherwise, we're worsening the city for such a long time just to make it nice in a few years' time. It doesn't seem like a good strategy. Herman and Corin, let's talk about major construction happening in Jerusalem. How could the municipality strike that balance a bit better? Over to you two.
You know, Herman, I was listening back to that audio Daniel sent us while he was walking down King George Street, and you can really hear the city breathing through all that construction noise. It is that classic Jerusalem soundscape lately, isn't it? The grinding of heavy machinery, the backup beepers, and that specific kind of frantic energy that comes when a city is essentially performing open-heart surgery on itself.
It is exactly that, Korn. Herman Poppleberry here, by the way, for those just tuning in. And you are right, it is visceral. Our housemate Daniel is right in the thick of it, and he is not alone. Every time I step out of the house lately, I feel like I'm navigating a giant, dusty maze. But that prompt he sent really gets to the core of a massive tension we are seeing, not just here in Jerusalem, but in booming cities all over the world. How do you build for the version of the city that will exist in 20 years without absolutely destroying the lives of the people who live here today?
It is a profound question, because the scale of the light rail project, this whole JNet network, is staggering. We are talking about expanding from the single red line we have had for over a decade to a full grid that covers the entire city. But as Daniel mentioned, for the guy at the computer store or the residents who have been dealing with dust since 7 in the morning, the promise of a seamless commute in 2031 feels very, very far away.
It really does. And we have to be honest about the history here to understand why people are so skeptical. Remember, the original Red Line, which finally opened back in August of 2012, was famous for its delays. It was supposed to be finished years earlier, and by the time the first train actually rolled down Jaffa Road, dozens of small businesses had already gone under. They just could not survive years of being behind a construction fence. So when the municipality says, "Trust us, this time will be different," people like Daniel and his friend at the tech shop have every reason to raise an eyebrow.
Well, let's dig into that skepticism. Because if we look at the current phase, specifically the work on the green and blue lines, the ambition has tripled. The total network is planned to reach over 40 kilometers of track. That is a lot of digging, a lot of utility relocation, and a lot of disrupted sidewalks. Herman, from your research, what is actually different this time in terms of how the city is managing the impact? Or is it just the same old playbook with a bigger budget?
Well, they are trying a few things, but whether they are working is the big debate. One strategy the Jerusalem Municipality and the Moriah Jerusalem Development Corporation have touted is more aggressive night work to speed things up. That is why Daniel sees those crews with the big floodlights at 2 in the morning. The idea is to compress the timeline. If you can do 2 days of work in 24 hours, you get out of the neighborhood faster. But then you run into the quality of life issue. If you are a resident on King George or Karen Hayesod, you are choosing between 3 years of daytime noise or 18 months of no sleep. It is a brutal trade-off.
And it is not just the noise, right? It is the physical accessibility. I was walking near the city center the other day, and I saw an elderly woman trying to navigate a temporary plywood ramp that was covered in fine white stone dust. It looked incredibly dangerous. When we talk about a livable environment, we are talking about the basic ability to move through your own neighborhood. If a project makes it impossible for a person with a stroller or a wheelchair to get to the grocery store, has the city failed its primary duty?
I think it has, in the short term. And this is where the planning often falls short. They focus on the engineering of the track, but they treat the pedestrian experience as an afterthought. There is this concept in urban planning called tactical urbanism, where you use temporary, low-cost interventions to keep a space functional during a transition. In some cities, when they do major rail work, they actually build elevated, covered walkways that are bright, clean, and separated from the dust. They turn the construction fences into art galleries. Here, it often feels like we just get a plastic orange barrier and a sign that says, "Good luck."
It is interesting you mention the fences. In some of those European projects we have looked at, they actually mandate that the construction barriers have windows or viewing ports so people can see what is happening. It sounds small, but it reduces that feeling of being trapped behind a wall. It makes the residents feel like participants in a transformation rather than victims of a siege. But let's talk about the small businesses, because that is where the economic heart of the city lives. Daniel mentioned the tech shop owner being frustrated. If I am a business owner and my foot traffic drops by 60% because of a trench in front of my door, what is the city doing to keep me afloat?
That is the million-dollar question, Korn. or rather the multi-billion shekel question. Historically, Jerusalem has been quite slow to offer direct financial compensation. There have been some reductions in property tax, what we call arnona, for businesses directly impacted by the light rail work. But as any shop owner will tell you, a 20% discount on your taxes does not make up for a 60% drop in revenue. You still have rent, you still have inventory, and you still have staff to pay.
Right. And if you go out of business, the city loses its soul. We talked about this back in episode 360, when we were discussing the ghost apartments and the luxury towers. If the light rail eventually connects a bunch of empty high-rises, but all the local quirky shops on King George have been replaced by generic chains that can afford to weather the storm, did we actually improve Jerusalem?
Exactly. That is the second-order effect that worries me. Large-scale infrastructure often acts as a gentrification engine. The construction period is like a forest fire that clears out the smaller, more vulnerable species. Then, once the sleek new train arrives and property values spike, only the big corporate players can afford the new reality. To prevent that, the municipality needs a much more robust support system. I am talking about direct grants, not just tax breaks. Some cities have created marketing funds specifically for construction, affected zones, where the city pays for advertising to tell people, hey, the shops on this street are still open, here is how to get to them.
I like that. It is about active stewardship. But there is another layer to this, which is the sheer unpredictability of the timeline. Daniel mentioned that people are skeptical of the official dates. And let's be fair, construction in the city is notoriously difficult. You start digging a trench for a light rail cable, and you hit a 2,000-year-old Byzantine wall, or a Second Temple period mikveh. Everything stops for the archaeologists. How do you plan a livable city when the very ground you are building on is a historical minefield?
It is a unique challenge, no doubt. The Israel Antiquities Authority is basically a permanent member of the construction crew here, but that is why the planning needs to be more modular. Instead of opening a 3-kilometer stretch of road all at once and leaving it open for years, you can use a technique called rolling work zones. You finish a 100-meter segment completely, including the sidewalks and the final paving, before moving to the next block. It is more expensive and it takes more coordination, but it means no single business is staring at a trench for 7 years.
That makes so much sense. It is about minimizing the duration of the peak pain for any one individual. But I want to go back to something Daniel mentioned in his prompt, which was the timing of all this. He mentioned that after October 7th, 2023, things seem to change with the labor market and the pace of work. We know that the construction industry in Israel faced a massive vacuum when tens of thousands of workers were suddenly unable to reach sites. While there have been efforts to bring in workers from places like India or Sri Lanka, that transition is not instant. Does that explain why some of these sites look abandoned at times?
It is a major factor. You have these massive projects that were greenlit and started under one set of labor assumptions, and then the world changed. If you have the machinery in place and the road dug up, but you only have half the crew you need to actually pour the concrete or lay the track, the project just stretches out into this agonizing limbo. For a resident, seeing a road closed but no one actually working on it is the ultimate frustration. It feels like a lack of respect for their time and their lives.
It creates this feeling of powerlessness, and I think that is the core of the quality of life issue. It is not just the dust, it is the feeling that the city is doing something to you, rather than for you. So, if we were sitting down with the city planners, what are the actual strategies we would propose to strike the better balance? We have talked about rolling work zones and direct financial aid. What else is in the toolkit?
One big one is communication transparency. Not just a glossy brochure, but a real-time, honest dashboard. If a project is delayed because of an archaeological find or a labor shortage, tell people. Explain what is happening and why. When people understand the reason for the delay, their blood pressure goes down, even if the inconvenience remains. Also, we need to talk about micromobility. During construction, the city should be flooding the area with subsidized electric scooters or bike share programs that can navigate the narrow paths that cars and buses can no longer use.
I love the idea of the city providing the solution to the problem they created. If you take away my bus stop, give me a free voucher for a bike share to get to the next one. It shows a level of empathy that is often missing from these massive bureaucratic projects. But Herman, let's look at the long-term vision for a second. We have been a bit critical of the process, but the goal is a Jerusalem where you don't need a car. A city where a kid from Gilo can get to the Hebrew University in 20 minutes without sitting in traffic on Hebron Road. That is a beautiful vision, isn't it?
It is a transformative vision. If the JNET project succeeds, Jerusalem becomes one of the most accessible, sustainable cities in the Middle East. It reduces air pollution, it connects disparate neighborhoods, and it creates a sense of shared public space. The Red Line already did that to some extent. You see everyone on that train, religious, secular, Jews, Arabs, tourists. It is a rare place of intersection in a very divided city, so the payoff is immense. The tragedy is that the people paying the highest price for that future are the ones who might not even be here to see it.
That is the generational unfairness of infrastructure. We are asking the current generation of small business owners to sacrifice their livelihoods so that the next generation can have a better commute. It feels like we are missing a mechanism to bridge that gap. What if the city offered long-term, low-interest loans to these businesses that are only repayable once the light rail is operational and their property value has increased? You are basically allowing them to borrow against the future value the city is creating.
That is brilliant, Korn. It is essentially a value capture mechanism for the little guy. Usually, only the big developers get to play that game. They buy land near a future station and wait for the windfall. If we could give the local shop owner a way to capture some of that future upside now, it would change the whole incentive structure. They would become stakeholders in the project's success rather than victims of its construction.
And it would change the conversation at the dinner table, too. Instead of Daniel and his friend just venting about the noise, they might be talking about how they are going to renovate the shop once the station opens next door. It shifts the mindset from survival to investment. But let's be realistic, Herman. We live in a city with a lot of competing priorities and a very complex political landscape. Do you think there is a genuine appetite in the municipality for this kind of empathetic planning?
I think there is a growing realization that the old way isn't sustainable. They saw what happened with the Red Line. They know that if they lose the support of the public, the political cost is huge. But there is also a lot of inertia. These are massive contracts with massive companies, and change is slow. However, I am seeing more community managers being assigned to neighborhoods, people whose entire job is to be the liaison between the residents and the engineers. It is a start, but they need more power to actually change things on the ground, not just to listen to complaints.
It is about moving from PR to actual policy. You know, I was thinking about our episode on the Jerusalem Gateway Project, episode 204. We talked about how that whole area at the entrance to the city is being turned into a high-tech hub. The light rail is the nervous system for that whole plan. If the nervous system is built in a way that paralyzes the body for a decade, the whole project is at risk. There is a real danger of creating a city that is technically advanced but socially hollowed out.
That is the ultimate risk. We don't want a city of glass towers and empty trains. We want a city of people. And that means protecting the people who are here now. I think another strategy we have to consider is the concept of the 15-minute city, even during construction. How do we ensure that every neighborhood still has its essential services within a 15-minute walk, even if the main thoroughfare is a construction site? Maybe that means the city helps set up temporary pop-up markets or mobile clinics in neighborhoods that are particularly cut off.
That is a great practical takeaway. If you cut off the path to the pharmacy, you bring the pharmacy to the people. It is about flexibility. You know, Herman, I think about Daniel's asthma that he mentioned in the prompt. The dust isn't just an annoyance for him. It is a health issue. In some cities, they use high-pressure water misters on construction sites to keep the dust down. It is a standard requirement. Why isn't that happening more consistently here?
It should be. It is often a matter of enforcement. The regulations are usually there in the contract, but if the city inspectors are stretched thin, or if they prioritize speed over health, those misters don't get used. This is where citizen engagement comes in. People need to know what the standards are so they can demand them. If the contract says the site must be watered down every 2 hours to prevent dust, the residents should have a way to report when it isn't happening.
It is about holding the contractors accountable. We often treat these big projects as if they are a force of nature, like a storm we just have to endure. But they are human choices. Every decision, from the height of a fence to the frequency of a water mister, is a choice made by someone in an office, and those choices should be centered on the people who have to live with them.
Absolutely. And I think we are seeing a shift in the global conversation about this. You look at cities like Copenhagen or even parts of Paris where they have done massive renovations. They treat the construction phase as an opportunity for urban experimentation. They might close a street to cars, but open it up for a massive community dinner on the weekend. It sounds idealistic for Jerusalem, but why not? If the cars are gone anyway, let's use the space for something that brings us together.
I can just imagine a giant Shabbat table in the middle of a half-finished King George Street. That would be so Jerusalem. It would take the edge off the frustration, wouldn't it? It would remind everyone why we live here in the first place. It is not for the light rail. It is for the community.
Exactly. So, to wrap up our thoughts on Daniel's prompt, I think the strategy for a better balance has to be three-pronged. First, financial empathy, direct support for businesses, not just tax breaks. Second, engineering flexibility, rolling warp zones, and better pedestrian infrastructure. And third, radical transparency, honest communication, and accountability for things like noise and dust.
And don't forget the micro-mobility and essential service pop-ups. If we can't get to the city has to come to us. It is a big shift in mindset, but I think it is the only way to keep Jerusalem livable during this massive transition. We are building a city for the future, but we have to live in it today.
Well said, Korn. It is a long road ahead, quite literally, but I am hopeful. Every time I see that red line train glide past the old city walls, I am reminded of how much better things can be when we get it right. We just have to make sure we don't lose our soul along the way.
I think that is a perfect place to leave it. Daniel, thanks for the prompt and for braving the dust on King George to send it. It really got us thinking about the city we all share.
Definitely. And to our listeners, we know many of you are dealing with these same issues, whether you are here in Jerusalem or in another city undergoing a major transformation. We would love to hear your thoughts. How is your city handling the balance between the future and the present?
And hey, if you've been enjoying the show, a quick review on your podcast app or on Spotify really helps us out. It helps other people find these deep dives into the weird and wonderful prompts we get. We have been doing this for over 200 episodes now, and your support is what keeps us going.
It really does. You can find our full archive, including those episodes we mentioned on the Jerusalem Gateway and Ghost Apartments, at our website, myweirdprompts.com. There is a contact form there, too, if you want to send us your own prompt.
Thanks for listening to My Weird Prompts. I am Korn.
And I am Herman Poppleberry. We will see you in the next one, hopefully with a bit less dust in our lungs.
Take care, everyone.
Bye for now.
So, Herman, do you actually think they will finish the blue line by 2030?
Honestly, Korn, I would bet my favorite fountain pen that we are still talking about this in 2032. But hey, a man can dream.
I will hold you to that bet. I have had my eye on that pen for a while.
You wish. All right, let's go see what Daniel is making for dinner. I think it is his turn.
If it is his famous spicy shakshuka, I am in.
Me too. See you guys later.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.